Blog Talk Radio.
Spingola Zone. It is Tuesday, March 18th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola, and this weekly radio program is sponsored by the American Free Press, whose website is AmericanFreePress.net. I have been a subscriber to that newspaper and highly recommend a subscription to it, as well as a subscription to the wonderful historical journal, The Barnes Review. Their website is barnesreview.org, and that's spelled B-A-R-N-E-S, barnesreview.org. Please visit both websites and support the efforts of the people who report accurate history and contemporary events. My websites are spingola.com and spingolaspeaks.info. Our call-in number is 347-215-7292. We will also be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room. And if you'd like to visit the chat room, that address is spingola.chatango.com. Please join others there. Our guest this hour is Mike Campbell. He is the author of Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, which was published on June 21st, 2012, and the co-author with Thomas Devine of With Our Own Eyes, Eyewitnesses to the Final Days of Amelia Earhart, published in 2002. Mike is a member of the Amelia Earhart Society of Researchers. His website is EarhartNews.com. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Deanna. Great to be with you again. The website, I don't know where you got Earhart News. That's not the right website.
Oh, Earhart,
it's Earhart Truth.
Truth. Yes. Did I say Earhart News? I'm sorry.
Yes, you did.
It is EarhartTruth.net. Okay.
.com.
.com.
EarhartTruth.com, Deanna.
I was just seeing if you were awake.
I'm very much awake. It's really good to be with you again, you know, and to talk about this. This will be the third time. You must be my favorite radio host by now. You are one of the few, scant few out there in the media, and I mean even alternative media, that will entertain the truth in the Earhart matter. It is becoming worse by the day out there. I don't even know where to start to tell you the kind of resistance this book has met, you know, wherever we turn. You know, why don't you guide me somewhere and I'll just follow your directions.
Well, I just find that just amazing. I love history. I feel that it's imperative that we learn accurate history. And I think your book is wonderful. I just cannot imagine that everybody wasn't waiting to hear about it, to learn about it, to read it. And when it came out, I think I contacted you even before it was available, because I thought, oh, this is fabulous. We've all heard about the flight. We all know that she disappeared. And that is always a mystery. And I think mysteries are people want to know about these things. At least I did. And so that's why I initially contacted you. I think, yes, I'm sure I contacted you. And I'm not sure
very
how
early.
I heard about you, but I just felt, gosh, this is so exciting. And then we had two interviews before today. And we've also chatted via email. But the book has not sold as well as you anticipated. And I think, Mike, you put so much of your time into this. You put decades into this.
Well, actually, yes. I mean, the book is the result of about, I don't know, 20 years of work, you know, off and on, but concentrated from 2006 when I actually began to do a new edition of With Our Own Eyes, and that was how this book got started. And then and then the publisher of With Our Own Eyes was somehow warned off about doing a second edition with 100 pages of new information, and she dropped it like a hot potato. I mean, this story is becoming more radioactive by the day. It's almost as if FDR is walking among us, and he must be respected. I mean, you have, congratulations, by the way, on your new program. You must have a lot of new listeners. I don't know, you know, so I don't know if where to start as, with the story. I think it, to be fair to your listeners, though, I think it's best, Deanna, to start at the beginning to make some sort of logical sense about what the public knows about the Earhart matter and what really happened in the Earhart matter are two completely different events. I don't think there's any event in American history that is as misunderstood and misreported as the Earhart disappearance, with the possibility of the JFK hit. However, the big difference with the JFK hit is that hundreds of books have been published, and the public has been exposed to all the truth in the JFK hit, I mean, in waves, so that there's a common cliche out there nowadays that 90% of the American people know that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK, then the other 10% are the mainstream media.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the only thing that even compares, but it doesn't, it's the parallels just wear out quickly because there's only been a few books done that present the truth in the Earhart case. All that people hear nowadays is about Rick Gillespie and Tygar going back to this island for the 10th time, or actually they want to go back for the 11th time this coming summer. They've been there 10 times, found nothing to connect her with, nothing on the island, on Nicomoraro to connect her with, connect Earhart to the island. This is all just disinformation that's constantly being fed to American people. Let's start from the beginning. The modern-day search for Amelia Earhart, Deanna, began in 1960 with Paul Briand's book, Daughter of the Sky. This is a book that I'm sure very few of your listeners, except the ones that may have heard our interviews before, are familiar with. It's very hard to find this book. It's very rare now. But the book was published in 1960 by Paul Briand, who was a English professor at the Air Force Academy. The book was basically just a standard bio of Amelia. If you'd go to Amazon and you plug in the words Amelia Earhart on the Amazon search engine, you will get 1,800 books come up on her. 99.9% of those books are biographies about her life and how wonderful she was as a flyer, as an aviator, and as a human being. There's no question that she's one of the most accomplished women that ever lived, okay? But all that she's going to be, all that she's still remembered for is her disappearance. On the other hand, all you see is biography. Nobody can answer. It's almost as if the question is such a sacred cow that people don't even want to touch the story. But Briand did in 1960. He was told by Dr. Casimir Schecht, who was a dentist on Saipan in the late 40s. Dr. Casimir Schecht was told by his dental assistant on Saipan. Her name was Josephine Blanco Akiyama. He was told by her about the white woman that landed at Tanapag Harbor in 1937 in the summer. She was 11 years old at the time. She went and she saw. She was at the harbor bringing lunch to her brother at the time. She saw the white woman and the white man come out of the airplane. She saw them on the banks of on the shore there at Tanapag Harbor. Everybody knew that it was the American lady pilot, and they disappeared right after that. From there, that account was the only thing that Briand was able to get into the back of his book, Daughter of the Sky, in 1960. Now, that book, as soon as that book hit the street, a newsman named Linwood Day from the San Mateo Times newspaper found that Josephine Blanco Akiyama was living in San Mateo, California, the woman that Casimir Chef talked about. He went to interview her. He started writing stories about her accounts of the white woman flyer on Saipan in 1937. Fred Gerner then saw the stories in the San Mateo Times. Fred Gerner was a well-known radio newsman in San Francisco, KCBS. So Fred Gerner went and interviewed Josephine, believed her story. Then he went to Saipan, Gerner did, with Linwood Day, his first of four trips to Saipan to interview eyewitnesses to the presence and death of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on Saipan. As a result of Gerner's initial investigations, his book, The Search for Amelia Earhart, was published in 1966, which absolutely, to any normal, rational observer, would say established the fact that Amelia Earhart was on Saipan with Fred Noonan in 1937, and that's where they died. This book that Gerner had in 1966 sold 400,000 copies and really shook up this country. Congressmen were having their doors beaten down constantly by people. This is I was 16 at the years old at the time. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what was going on. And for some reason, it wasn't being covered in the newspapers, even though there was so many books being, yeah, so the Washington Post never had a word about it in those, even though so many copies were bought. The word got out somehow. But at one point during Gerner's investigations on July 1st, 1960, the San Mateo Times ran the headline, Amelia Earhart, mystery is solved. Famed aviatrix died on Saipan. That headline in the San Mateo Times was not picked up by any other newspaper in this country. And it was not
that
an accident.
That is amazing.
That's right. It was not an accident why that headline was ignored. And that newspaper was the only newspaper was publicizing that was printing the truth about what happened to Earhart. But the word was out, and the cat was out of the bag, okay? That she was on Saipan. Gerner's book in 1966 represents about 5% of the information in the eyewitness testimony, the documents, and all the other information that we have now since 1966, the overwhelming evidence that shows that she was on Saipan with Fred Noonan, and that's where they died. There is no competing theory anymore. There are no other ideas, although that the mainstream and the establishment wants the public to think is that it's a mystery. It's still one of the greatest mysteries of the 20th century. They want everybody to believe this. It's nothing but a lie.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I just keep going.
it's just
outrageous. Okay, what's been going on? Now, I was as an example of this. I was talking earlier at the start of your show. We were talking a little bit about the Tigar Group. They are the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. They are the media's selected agent of disinformation in the Earhart case now, and they've been that way for 25 years. Starting in 1989, when they came back from their first trip, and they tried to link the an aviator's or a navigator's bookcase or that they found on the island to the Earhart plane, they have been getting all the publicity in the world. They're on Discovery Channel, Discovery News, you name it. They're all that the man in the street sees about the Earhart plane. Even though they can't find anything to link her to the plane, she still should have landed there. So he's supposed to go back this summer with $3 million, of whose money is a good question, with the sonar equipment and search again off the island for the Electra. It's just an absolute outrage to anybody that understands what really is going on in the Earhart case. Gillespie was photographed 2 summers ago, Deanna, with Hillary Clinton before he went on his 10th trip to the island. I don't know about you. If I had my picture taken with Hillary Clinton on any sort of an investigation I was going on, I think I'd lose whatever credibility I had would just about be out the window.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want my picture taken with her under any circumstances, actually.
There you go. There you go. But what this photograph and what this photo op tells us is that the government is no longer even pretending that they don't know what happened to Amelia Earhart. They are not even pretending to be stupid. They are just making it completely obvious that their whole idea is to keep people confused and dumb about what happened to her. Meanwhile, every single media outlet that I contact, with rare exceptions, very few people like you, there's just a handful of them out there, and people can see where I've been on my website. I keep a pretty good record of the different interviews I've done. These are all independent types that aren't bought and sold in the media marketplace, who have stood up and done the best they could to stand up for the truth in the air and to help me get the word out. But it's where, you know, there are just few and far between. So many people have told me they were going to help me, but then when they found out what it was all about, when they found out that the Japanese had her and that she died in Japanese hands after 1937 and that FDR left her hanging out to dry, when they found out the ugly truth and the unpleasant facts about the Earhart case, all of a sudden they didn't know me anymore and they didn't want to talk about it on their air.
I just find that amazing because I mean, I think that this is essential to know, and she was a heroine, and he just, as you say, just ignored her, FDR ignored her, ignored the situation, and it's been a cover-up ever since. And why the cover-up, Mike? Why is this covered up? Why shouldn't the people know exactly what happened?
Well, it's all about politics, and it goes back to protecting FDR. But however, you know, it would be huge news that FDR left her on Saipan at the whims of the Japanese in 1937 after he learned that she was there. Now, the critics of this will say it's too late, there's too many years have passed, FDR is dead, and it doesn't matter. They will say this is a false theory that you have, that the media is protecting and the establishment is protecting the Earhart, or the truth about Earhart, and because of FDR and his involvement. That is an outright, flat-out lie. He is still the revered father of the modern Democrat Party, and if it ever became known that he let Amelia Earhart die on Saipan at the hands of the Japanese, his legacy, whatever is left of it, anybody with two brain cells together can look up some history on FDR and find out what a bad actor he was and what a bad guy he was. We won the war despite his efforts, not because of them. And he got us into Pearl Harbor on purpose. I mean, his legacy is in tatters anyway to anybody with half a brain. But if it became known that he let Amelia Earhart out to dry, that would be it. I mean, it would be huge. They'd have to go back. They'd have to redo all the history books. I mean, it would just be a huge embarrassment for the Democrat Party, something they might never recover from, you know? I mean,
exactly.
It's just, and you know, and the skeptics and the critics all try to poo-poo that idea, and that's all they can do. That's all they can do, because that's the truth.
Right. Well, I think, too, the whole history of World War II is a big fabrication, and of course, the victors write the history, but there was a reason why he left her over there, and there's so many other issues involved. You even talk about Forrestal. You talk about neighbors and the Forrestal connection. You talk about a lot of things in your book, and I highly recommend that people purchase your book because it is a piece of history that I think everyone certainly needs to know, and they can purchase your book at Amazon, of course.
Deanna, it's just been so difficult to sell this book. However, the people that do look for it can find it, just like the people that want to look for the truth in the Earhart case can find it. Not only with me. I'm not the first one to come out with this. Paul Brand and then Fred Gerner. Now, Fred Gerner, getting back to him, his book was the only bestseller because his book caught the establishment with their pants down. They weren't ready for that. And as soon as they recovered, they sent their minions to Time magazine, which was the major media organ at the time in the 60s. You know, there was very few. Time magazine. I don't even know if Newsweek had even come into existence yet. But Time magazine was the preeminent news magazine of the day. Time magazine trashed Gerner's book, saying that it barely held together and that he presumed to speak for the American and Japanese governments. I mean, it was really a horribly weak review, trying to make Gerner look like a fool. And it was just an obvious, hit job on Gerner, this Time review. But that signaled, that put the signal out there to all the lemmings in the media and everybody else. We don't talk about Saipan anymore. We don't deal with Saipan. We don't talk about the truth in the Earhart matter. It's just off limits. And from then on, it's been getting worse all the time. There's been very, very few other books that actually came out after Gerner's and presented the truth. There are less than a handful. Thomas Devine's book in 1987, Eyewitness the Amelia Earhart Incident. Now, Thomas Devine is the one who I contacted when I was doing the story in 1988 as a Navy reporter. Amazingly, the Navy group that I was working for in 1988 didn't have a clue about what happened in the Earhart disappearance, and they allowed me to write a story presenting the facts as I saw them in my research. So the Navy put out actually some of the truth inadvertently to their own people across the world in 1988 via the story that I did in 1988. And then I met Thomas Devine, who did the great book, probably the second most important book to Gerner's, in 1987. I witnessed the Amelia Earhart Incident, all about Devine's experiences on Saipan in 1944 as a GI during the invasion of Saipan. Devine saw the Earhart airplane three times, and he saw the airplane destroyed on Saipan. And later on, Devine got other GIs who were on Saipan who also knew about the plane there and also saw it destroyed. They contacted him with their accounts. And even though his book was greatly suppressed, the word still got out, mostly via the fact that Devine was allowed to be on Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack in 1990. Now, that is the last time that anything on network TV was whispered. Well, basically, one of the last times. I can be corrected on that, but I'll get to that in a second.
Wow.
Devine was allowed basically to tell his basic story on Unsolved Mysteries in 1990. As soon as that show came out, It just sort of disappeared. It wasn't on the air for much longer after that, and I don't know if there's any connection at all. But later on in the 90s, with Connie Chung, Robert Wallach appeared. Robert Wallach was a good friend of Devine's who contacted him in 1990 or 89, shortly after he found out about Devine's book. Now, Robert Wallach found Amelia Earhart's briefcase on Saipan in a blown safe on Garapan, which was the capital of Saipan. Wallach was in the second wave of Marines to hit the beach on Saipan. After the island was secure, he was with his friends, going around the island and scuffling for things, and I forget the word right now, it escapes me, but, you know, they were like scavengers. And they found, Robert Wallach found her briefcase dry and in a safe that they blew, and later on the man that did that, that did the safe job actually came forward and supported Wallach's account. And Wallach died at the age of 83 in 2008. He was a good friend of mine, and we were always on the phone. He found that briefcase, and Connie Chung had him on in the mid-90s to talk about that briefly on her show, Eye to Eye. That is the last time anything has been mentioned about Saipan on network television, unless it's some passing, deprecating remark by somebody. National Geographic did a special in 2007 presenting the Saipan scenario, but nobody saw it. It was on National Geographic. Who gets that? I was surprised they even did it, but even National Geographic suppressed my book, the book that I wrote with Thomas Devine, with their own eyes. They wouldn't let that be, they wouldn't let Wallach mention it, and so that, you know, I mean, it's just, what's one thing after the other, but
sure.
The major idea is that throughout the media, Deanna, I mean, it's just like hands off. We don't talk about this. Now, to give you an example of you know, some people believe that Fox News it might be a little bit more honest than other channels. The other night, Megyn Kelly, talking about the Malaysian jetliner loss on Friday night, Megyn Kelly had a group of aviation experts on her show, and one of those aviation experts was Rick Gillespie. Now, this guy is the executive head of Tigar. He's actually he is Tigar. The people that we talked about, the people that keep going back to the island every other year, ostensibly to look for Earhart, who was supposed to have landed on Nicomoraro. Gillespie was on Fox's aviation panel. This is a guy that has been back 10 times to an island, found nothing, but yet he's going to give us advice on how the plane from Malaysia should be found.
Oh, my goodness. What are your thoughts on the Malaysia plane?
I'll tell you one thing. It has very little to do with the Earhart loss. That's about the most succinct thing I can say.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I'm not smart about all the high-tech stuff. There's been 1,000 things put out. This is a I think one thing. It's not going to end well, that's for sure.
Sure. Now, the Japanese kept Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, her navigator, were in prison in a cell block. And in your book, you have the pictures of the cell block. And, I mean, they were imprisoned there and kept there.
And it was common knowledge. Absolutely.
Yes. And everybody knew it. And her plane, how did they destroy her plane? Wasn't it in a hangar and then they blew the hangar? Tell us about the destruction of the plane.
Well, the plane was taken out of the hangar. We think now during research is still going on, believe it or not. We are still learning things about this. There's plenty more to learn. I mean, there's lots of unanswered questions, lots of them. The big one, however, the one that the media pretends is not answered, the big question, you know, the big picture question, we've known that since Gerner was on Saipan. I mean, we've known that that's where she wound up, and that's where she died. Now, her airplane was the biggest piece of evidence that they had to get rid of. And Devine and a few other Marines actually saw the plane taken out. Devine saw the plane after it was torched, not when it was taken out. Erskine Neighbors, who was a Marine wire code operator, actually saw the plane being taken out of the hangar where it was being stored at Islito Airfield. That's the name of the Japanese airfield on Saipan. The plane was taken out. Aviation fuel was dumped all over the airplane, according to Neighbors and one other witness. And a plane, a P-38, came over and shot the plane up, ignited it in the flames, and it was burned up about as well as you can burn up an aluminum airplane to make it unrecognizable. And there it sat there in the corner of Islito Field, according to Devine, for several months until eventually it was bulldozed into rubble in a deep ditch with hundreds of other tons of metal of other planes from Esalito Airfield. Most of them were the Japanese planes that were destroyed during the invasion of Saipan. So the Electra, Earhart's airplane, is under the airport at Saipan International Airport with, you know, untold other hundreds or thousands of tons of metal from World War II. That's where it is.
Wow. Now, what was the connection between Nabors and James Forrestal? What was the deal there?
Well, there was no real connection between Nabors and Forrestal. What I talk about is the connection. Actually, I named a title, the Nabors-Forrestal connection. Is that what I,
mm-hmm,
is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
I did. Nabors and the Forrestal connection. Yes. You know what? If I had to write that title again, you've reminded me of something. I could have probably named that title a little bit better. Now, the reason that I threw those two names into the title is because Devine was absolutely certain that he saw James V. Forrestal, the Secretary of the Navy, on Saipan in 1944 during the invasion. Devine was sure of it, that he saw Forrestal giving orders to Marines around the hangar and around the administration building, and that Forrestal was in charge of that operation in person, okay? Well, we did a lot of looking into that, Deanna. We did a lot of investigating on Forrestal and where he was at the time, and there's absolutely no way that they could have faked that paperwork to have him on Saipan. There's too much information that puts him in the United States, in Washington, and in Philadelphia at the key dates. He could not have been on Saipan. There is no other record of him being on Saipan. Nobody ever claimed that he was on Saipan. So that's where I get that. Well, not I guess where I get half of it. Forrestal, yes, he knew. He certainly knew about this. This order to destroy the airplane came from FDR, but it went through Forrestal. He had to be completely aware of it as being the number one Navy man, Secretary of the Navy. And so, sure, he knew about it, but he wasn't there. There might have been a guy there that looked like him, and we think his name was James Nichols, a guy who was the nephew of James Nichols, wrote a letter to Devine in 2001 telling him about his uncle that was sent to the Saipan on an intelligence mission to get rid of the Earhart evidence. And so we did due diligence on this guy's story, who still doesn't want to be named, and it doesn't matter what his name is, what the nephew's name is. It matters what the uncle's name was, and that was James H. Nichols. He was one of the intelligence people on Saipan in charge of the destruction of the airplane, and we're still trying to nail down more on Nichols. We know that he was in the Navy earlier in the 30s as an enlisted person, and we've been told that he was an officer, but we can't find his record. His officer record is not available. I think there's a good reason why his officer record isn't available, and you can guess what that might be.
Sure.
Might place him on Saipan. There's lots of records that have gone missing, such as all the listening stations, Navy listening stations in the Pacific that would have been taking Japanese radio signals during the Earhart flight. There was three key radio stations in the Pacific, Navy high-frequency direction finder stations, that would have had the records of the Japanese intercepts during the Earhart flight. All those records are gone, all of them. There's no records from 1935 until 1940 from those radio stations. I mean, they didn't just remove the Earhart records or the Japanese records during those times, during the key dates. They just got rid of everything, like trying to kill a fly with an elephant. I mean, it was just, this has been discovered recently through research. They're not even subtle about their willingness to get rid of records.
Wow. Okay, so the big motivation for them to just kill this story, to not reveal this, is, for the sake of the current Democratic Party and for the FDR's his reputation. But why was she there? What was she doing?
Good questions. Good questions. We don't know. This is one of the biggest questions, okay, about the Earhart mystery. One of the biggest questions that we still have yet to answer is, did she fly? Did Amelia Earhart fly to Amelia Toll? I think before we get to that, I think just for your listeners that might have been tuning in, we've been into this conversation for 35 minutes, and I think it's good to mention the name of the book again.
Absolutely.
Of the book. Go ahead, Deanna, you do it.
Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. And this is available at Amazon. It's a fabulous book. I recommend that everyone buy it. It should be part of everyone's library regarding World War II. If you don't have the book, you are missing a piece of the puzzle. I really believe that that everyone who's interested in World War II should have it, and particularly because it does have something to do with the Japanese, the war in the Pacific, and I just think you need to have this book. And your website, again, is EarhartTruth.com, EarhartTruth.com, and people, please visit the website, and you can buy the book. There's a link to the book. It talks about the eyewitnesses. And, yes, please visit. There's pictures here. And I just, I think you've done a terrific job.
Thank you, Deanna.
Terrific job.
Well, it's all I've been doing, so I guess I've been pretty much focused on this for 26 years now. Getting back to what we were talking about, I wanted to mention one of the major reasons that has been put forward for the reason that FDR left her on Saipan and did not make it public that the Japanese had her was because we had broken the Japanese codes. This is another thing that plays into his motivations. It would have given up the fact that we had their codes but broken in 1937, which was a key. Well, they were building up to the war at that point. We definitely did not want the Japanese to know what our progress had been, with intelligence and signals intelligence and code breaking. So that was another motivation and another reason, not to make excuses for FDR, but I mean he did have a strategic reasons for letting her die on Saipan, but I still don't accept that. However, as the years progressed after the war and, as Truman and Eisenhower and the others took office, what's the motivation then to protect the Japanese and to protect the American public from misinformation? Well, I'll tell you what the major motivation is. It's the same as before, without the codes. It's to protect FDR's butt. That's what it was for, and just to protect his legacy. And nobody had the courage to step forward and reveal that information. Plus then, beginning in 1950, or actually soon after the war, where it was the agreement, our agreement with Japan was codified in 1950 with the San Francisco agreement under Truman, which made us and Japan best buds in the Pacific, and that we would never do anything to embarrass our buds in the Pacific. That's another reason that we have for not admitting officially what happened.
Sure. Yeah, she was sacrificed. And she was a heroine. She really was. She was the first person to solo. It was 2,408 miles from Honolulu to Oakland on January 11th, 1935. She was just a woman ahead of her time. She was...
Oh, absolutely.
She was.
She was arguably the most famous woman in the world, and she has. But since her loss, I mean, she's really got a lot of bad you know, she's got a lot of bad press from people. People say it was her fault. And she was very cavalier with the radios. And she was not good with radios. But that was why Noonan was there. And so where was Noonan? You know, and so you asked me before I went off into the codes about where they landed. What were they doing there? We don't know what they were doing there. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that she was asked to go and land at Mille Atoll, which was Japanese territory, mandated territory in the Marshall Islands, 1920 League of Nations, and there are. Those that believe, researchers that believe that she was asked to land there so that our Navy could come in and look for her and do their reconnaissance of Japanese militarization in the Marshall Islands to see what the Japanese were up to. This is very hard to believe. This is very hard to believe that she would actually submit to this. Even though there is evidence that she did, we have General Oscar Westover and Bernard Baruch had private meetings with her before she went off on her flights, on her world flight from Oakland in California at Marge Field. Margot DeCary, Earhart's secretary, told people about these meetings, and Margot DeCary said, let me quote her. She said, the Roosevelt administration needed something, and Baruch and Westover were sent to California as ambassadors to see if Amelia Earhart could help achieve the national objectives the administration had established. Actually, this is what one of the theorists, Roland Reinach, believed. Was a result of the meetings that these high-level officials had with Amelia Earhart before she left. No one else was allowed to sit in on those meetings. There's other evidence,
Well, the fact that a lot of people just felt like they wanted to do something for the country, and she was that kind of a person that would want to do something for her country, that had the ability, that had the skills to do that. And if she was sitting in, yes, with people like Bernard Baruch, yeah.
Amy Otis Earhart was Amelia's mother. She told, this was a famous interview she had with the Los Angeles Times in 1949. She told them, I am sure there was a government mission involved in the flight, because Amelia explained there were some things she could not tell me. I'm equally sure she did not make a forced landing in the sea. She landed on a tiny atoll, one of many in that general area of the Pacific, and was picked up by a Japanese fishing boat that took her to the Marshall Islands under Japanese control. Now, this is what Amy Earhart told the Los Angeles Times in 1949. How did Amy Earhart know that? Okay? That's an excellent question, isn't it? How did Mrs. Earhart know about that? Even more so, how did she know in 1944 when she was writing to Nita Snook Southern, who was Amelia's first flight instructor? Nita Snook taught Amelia how to fly in 1917 or 18, something like that. And Mrs. Earhart wrote in May 1944 to Nita Snook Southern about the theory that Amelia had gone down to the Marshall Islands as passed to a Navy man named Eugene Bogan via a native named Ajima. This is another. There were no books written in those times in 1944 for Mrs. Earhart to learn this. Where did she learn this? And I'm going to quote right now. This is something that we didn't talk about before, I don't believe. And
no,
I think I think it's incredibly revealing about what we knew and when we knew it, and that Mrs. Earhart, Amelia was known to be a good friend of the administration, especially Eleanor. She was known to be a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's. Now, this is what Mrs. Amy Otis Earhart, Amelia's mother, wrote to Nita Snook in 1944 now, in May. I'm quoting. Here I go. Bogan's story does happen to fit in with information brought me by a friend a few days after Amelia's SOS, who was listening to a former schoolmate shortwave radio when a broadcast from Tokyo came in saying they were celebrating there with parades because of Amelia's rescue or pickup by a Japanese fisherman, Mrs. Earhart wrote. That was before the war, you know, and evidently the ordinary Jap had no knowledge of their military leader's plans, so were proud of the rescue and expected the world to be. That young girl drove 27 miles at 11 o'clock at night and through a horrid part of Los Angeles to tell me. In other words, Mrs. Earhart was told by a girl that she knew who had heard a radio broadcast announcing that the Japanese had captured or had rescued her and taken her on a fishing boat in the Marshall Islands. The broadcast apparently came from Tokyo. This kind of stuff is just incredible stuff that is impossible to track down anymore. Now, if you go back, I mean, Vincent V. Loomis talks about some of this in his book, Amelia Earhart, The Final Story, that was published in 1985. There's some good work in there, but it's all very convoluted and confusing. The difference, Deanna, with this book, Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, is that we take everything significant that's been done, everything significant that shows the way from the Marshall Islands to Saipan and everything in between with the witnesses and all the things that establish the basic picture, the big picture. However, as I said before, we don't know why she landed at Milley. Were they north of Milley and lost a bit and they went and they followed the strong radio signal at Jaluit where they knew they could find a landfall? Or did they go to Milley on purpose, you know, for the reasons that I said earlier? If they went to Milley on purpose, this was one of the stupidest plans ever conceived in military intelligence history.
Wow. All righty. And so, and I'm on page 148, 149. And of course, her mother was very concerned about her because the Japs were known to torture and murder people. And of course, she was concerned about her daughter. But if she was there for a particular purpose, and she placed her trust in the FDR administration, And then they just left her there to die in order to cover up the fact that they had decoded all of the Japanese communications, which, of course, would implicate FDR in his foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, and where 2,400 people died. And there was foreknowledge that this was happening. And, in fact, Churchill and FDR monitored the entire trip from Japan to Pearl Harbor of the Japanese and knew what was going to take place. And so he left Amelia Earhart, America's heroine, in Japanese hands in order to protect this operation on Pearl Harbor so that they could get America into World War II in Europe, because Japan and Germany were allies at that point.
This is quite possible. It's quite possible it happened exactly as you just described it. And that's a pretty disgraceful thing. It absolutely is. It's just unbelievably disgraceful. And it all hinges on, I mean, if this is what happened, it all hinges on they assumed, how could they possibly assume that the Japanese were going to let them come in there and look in the Marshalls for Amelia Earhart? How could anybody be that stupid? Okay?
Right.
There was no reason for anybody to believe that the Japanese were going to allow anybody from the West to come into the Mandated Islands at that time in their history and look for Amelia Earhart. That's why it's so hard for me to buy this. That's why it's very, very hard. Even though we do have anecdotal evidence that she may have been asked to do this, it's still, I have to be convinced. Okay?
Right.
I really do have to be convinced.
Especially,
you know,
with the sanctions that America had put on Japan and the assets that they froze in America. Of course, that does make it very questionable, because that happened during the 30s, before her flight. Why would they assume that they would not, why would Americans assume that they wouldn't do exactly what they did with her, and that was incarcerate her and Fred Noonan and kill them?
Yeah, that's the hard part for, you know, that's the mystery. That is really the mystery to me, you know, but the big picture, I mean, we know where she was. We know where she landed on Millie. We have the witnesses on Millie. So much new information that this book presents that was found between 2002 and 2011. When I, you know, finally got the book into a situation where I could get it published. I mean, the rejections, I mean, to even get, it took me almost a year to find a publisher, that somebody that was decent enough, a decent enough publisher to even do this book. That's how unpopular this story is in the media. That is the, nowadays, anyone that really wants to find the truth about the Earhart case can find it. But, I mean, they're not going to find it anywhere but here and there with people, good people like you, and in books such as mine, Fred Gerner's, and Thomas Devine's. They're not going to find it anywhere else, because the media, not even the alternative media, is going to tell them that, the truth. Because it's obvious to me. However, we are running out of time, and I have some news that I do want to share with you and your listeners, and this is very encouraging to me. I finally think I have a little good, there's some light, you know, possibly at the end of the tunnel.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. In mid-December, my publisher told me that he was contacted by a lady who is a member of the Kansas chapter of the 99s. Now, do you know what the 99s are?
No.
The 99s are an international organization of licensed women pilots from 35 countries around the world, with a total membership of 5,500 members. The 99s are mostly, most of them are in this country. They were organized in 1929 by Louise Thaden, who was probably the second most famous woman pilot next to Amelia Earhart. In 1931, Amelia Earhart was named president of the 99s. She was the first president of the 99s. Okay, this is a super elite establishment organization of professional aviators. Okay, they are, you know, they're squeaky clean, they are spotless, and they are universally respected. This woman called my publisher, and she asked my publisher, Larry Knorr from Sunbury Press, if he thought I would be willing to come and speak to her group, having their conference in September. With other 99 chapters from 8 states. It's like a subsection or something they call it. So there'll be like about 100 members of the 99s. And now other groups are becoming possibly interested. My publisher said, yeah, I think he might be interested in doing that.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We've been back and forth, and we know, and now her name is Kay Alley. She is the vice chair of the Kansas chapter of the 99s. Now, isn't it amazing that it's the Kansas chapter that's doing this? That's where Amelia Earhart was born. She was born in Ages in Kansas. It's almost as if she's...
That's great.
Yeah, it's almost as if Amelia is telling me she's arranging this. She's got this in hand. And when I go and talk to these people, these are pure establishment types. For them to recognize this book and for them to sit there for 2 hours and listen to my presentation, that is a huge step forward.
Indeed. And this aspect that you brought into it, that you felt like she had a hand in it because she was born there, is just, it really kind of touched my heart, because I think you're onto something there. And I think that sometimes we don't really know why things work out the way that they do, and we don't know the connections between, well, I don't know, about the spirit world and what's going on here.
Sure.
But I think that this is fabulous. And I know that you're going to do a wonderful job, at like you always do, at presenting her story. You are her voice. You are probably her best voice. And that is why you've been selected to go to Kansas.
Well,
I think that's just terrific.
It's just as it's as I always said, Deanna, it only takes one person. It takes one person in the right place that we can start to make some movement with this and start to open the floodgates just a little bit. This woman, Kay Alley, you know, when I first heard about this, I said, well, Kay Alley, she might like my book, but she's never going to talk her friends into this. Her friends don't want to hear about this. And she had to talk her committee into this, and she had to talk a lot of people into this, because they're going to pay my expenses. I'm going to go and spend the weekend there. And she had to convince a lot of people, and she did. And I was amazed. I was amazed by that. So,
bless her heart. Now, when is this going to happen?
It's not going to happen for a while. It's the last weekend of September.
Okay.
So we got 6 months left. You know, I got 6 months to polish my PowerPoint presentation. I'm putting it together now. You know, it's going to be a 90-point PowerPoint and then a half an hour of discussion. And plus other events there, you know. And so there's going to be local media is going to be there. We're going to get a story in the local media. And this is all establishment. Finally entertaining the truth, you know. And I think I'm going to title my presentation something like, it's time to change the conversation, you know. It's time to change. Because, I mean, let's be realistic. The government is never going to get off of this. They're never going to admit the truth in our lifetimes. That's not going to happen. But to get at least some people, you know, people in policy positions in the media and other places to say, you know what, it does look like she died there on Saipan. This isn't really what they're telling us, you know. This isn't really what they're always pretending that it is. We
sure.
need to
and what's
change.
This gonna do? What's this going to do to Gillespie and his group and his claims and the money that's backing him? Is this going to have a dent in his portrayal of things?
We'll just have to wait and see, won't we?
Yes.
Right now Gillespie is facing $1 million lawsuit from one of the Mellons, who claims that Gillespie promised him that he would find the Earhart airplane, and he gave him $1 million, and Gillespie didn't find the airplane. This is being still litigated in court, and it might be one of the reasons why we're not getting the announcements about this summer more. We should have already had an announcement already that he's going back there with $3 million. So the Mellon suit is still hanging out there. I'm not sure what's going to happen. I don't think Mellon has a chance in the suit, because Gillespie is far too smart to put anything in writing that he's going to get burned for. There's no way he's going to do that. And so that's still out there. And I think Gillespie's done quite well for somebody with a phony theory.
Sure. Well, a lot of people with phony theories do a lot. They do very well. They put up websites. They collect money. They do all kinds of things. But they never quite fulfill their promises or make things happen. They just collect a lot of money and continue on. It's just amazing how they operate.
Yeah, some of them never, they never even get justice on this earth. But I believe that eventually everybody gets what they deserve, Deanna, whether it's down here or on the other side. You know, so I like to keep honest, and your listeners can be sure that there's not a single lie in this entire book, Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, not a single embellishment. This is all... the facts as they have been found, and they have been supported by so many different people. This is the most comprehensive, compelling, and convincing case ever written to establish the presence and death of Amelia and Fred Noonan on Saipan. There's no doubt about it.
Yes. You've put your heart and your life into it, and I believe that She's speaking through you. And we'll be in Kansas. Boy, this is super. This is really great.
How much time do we have left?
Well, I wanted to save it.
Are we done?
Yeah, in 45 seconds. But
okay.
Yes, and I thank you so very much for your work and for being on the program today. And I think it's great that you're going to Kansas.
Yeah, it is. We're all going to go to Kansas, and that's where we're gonna finally find some justice, maybe, for this story, you know.
Yes.
And I'll make sure that I show up and do the best possible job that I can. And I want to thank you so much for having me, Deanna. And we must do it again, you know.
Yes,
maybe after I go to Kansas,
we'll
talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome,
really appreciate
Deanna.
It.
And look forward to talking to you again. Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. That's the name of the book.
Yep. And it is available at Amazon. The website, again, is earharttruth.com. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks,
Diana.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All righty. Wonderful. I am just delighted that Mike is going to Kansas. This is fabulous. All righty. We have another guest in our second hour. And our next guest is James Perloff, and his website is James Perloff, and that's P-E-R-L-O-F-F, and I hope our producer is giving him a call right now. And alrighty, I don't think we're going to take a break. I think we're just going to keep going here. I think I'm on a roll. James Perloff is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and it is available in a Kindle at
James Perloff.
Amazon. Jim, are you there? Jim?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great, great. I was just introducing you. All righty.
I hope it was a good introduction. I didn't hear it, but here we go.
We have James Perloff. The website is jamesperloff.com, and he is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior and The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The American Decline. I forgot to unplug my phone here. And several other wonderful books. Anyway, we were just talking in our first hour with Mike Campbell, who wrote a book about Amelia Earhart, and the name of that book was Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, and was talking about her death on Saipan. And one of the motivations for her death was to cover up the idea that the American intelligence had broken the Japanese codes, and so they just kind of left her there to die in Japanese hands, rather than allow the Japanese to understand that they knew about the codes. Okay.
Well, that's a very good lead-in for our program, because we'll be talking more about those codes in this segment.
Yes, yes. I thought that would be just perfect. I thought the two of you would be a perfect combination for today. Okay, so tell us about the codes. Tell us about Pearl Harbor and whatever you'd like to share with us. I'm so happy to have you on.
Well, I'm so happy to be back, and I'm so glad that you're continuing to carry this fight, Deanna. Thank you so much for doing that. Well, I think first thing to do would be sort of set the context of World War II, in fact, the two world wars. You know, the Illuminati have always tried to implement what I call a three-headed hydra of globalism, communism, and Zionism. And in World War I, globalism took the shape of world government in the League of Nations, and that failed. World War II, case gave us a stronger world government in the form of the UN. And if there was ever a third world war, I'm sure they would want a total world government. We see the same progressiveness for the other two heads on the Hydra. Communism had its birthplace during World War I, of course, 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution. And then World War II was used to expand communism over half the globe into Eastern Europe and into Asia. And the third one, Zionism, of course, you had in 1917 the Balfour Declaration, by which Britain promised to secure a homeland for the Jewish people, and a letter to Lord Rothschild of the Zionist Federation. And then World War II made that a reality, and shortly thereafter, in 1948, you had Israel becoming a state, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the purpose is to enthrone the Antichrist in Jerusalem as the head of this world government. And I don't think it has anything truly to do with reviving biblical godly Israel, as some Christians believe. But having said that, general context, Japan and Pearl Harbor come into the context of I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree with you completely.
And I know you know a lot about World War II from seeing your guest lists. It's the communist contact that really brings pressure on Japan. And I'd like to mention for a moment how Japan was misrepresented, very similar to misrepresentations made about Germany. People were told that Japan was bent on world conquest. And if you want to get a great example of that, go onto YouTube and look for a film called Our Enemy, the Japanese. Was produced by the War Office for the Public. And in that film, you'll see Joseph Grew, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, telling people about Japan. And I'm going to quote, you can watch the film, but I'm going to quote what he says about the Japanese. He said that they believe it is, quote, the right and duty of Japan's emperors to rule the whole world, to destroy all peoples and nations which stand in the way of its fulfillment. And he said, quote, their actual dream is to see Tokyo established as the capital of the world. World conquest is their national obsession, unquote.
Jim?
Yes. Are you hearing me okay?
It is cutting out. Is there a line we can call you on to get to or maybe?
I'm not on a cell phone. I'm on a landline, which is reliable. Yeah. Can you hear me now? Or do you want to call me again?
Okay, reconnect and see if we can get a better... I will call. Let's go ahead and see if the can is better. Meanwhile, I'm going to talk about your book. I'm going to talk about you while
your you're call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 781.
Whoops, we'd want to... Okay. Our producer, Chris, is going to recall him. And remember, our guest this hour is James Perloff. His website is jamesperloff.com. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and that is on Kindle. He's also the author of The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The American Decline, which came out in 1988, and that is the first book that I had read by James Perloff, and I was very, very impressed with that. Anyway, we have him back on the line. Okay, James, pick it up from where you left off. Maybe you could do that quote again.
Okay, I was quoting Joseph Grew in this film you can see on YouTube, Our Enemy, the Japanese. He said it was the right, the Japanese felt it was, quote, the right and duty of Japan's emperors to rule the whole world, to destroy all peoples and nations which stand in the way of its fulfillment. He said, quote, their actual dream is to see Tokyo established as the capital of the world. World conquest is their national obsession, unquote. And while Grew is saying this, they show pictures of simply Japanese people eating food with chopsticks and coming out of subways. There's nothing whatsoever to substantiate his claim that they're after world conquest. And I'm sure that Grew, as a former ambassador to Japan, knew that Japan had actually been, for centuries, a closed, isolationist society. They only opened up when Commodore Perry came in the 1850s and, under the threat of naval bombardment, forced them to sign a trade agreement with America. They wanted to mind their own business. They had no interest in world conquest. But to validate this claim that the Japanese were attacking, can you hear me okay, by the way?
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Okay. It was claimed that the Japanese moving troops into northern China or Manchuria was evidence that they were bent on world conquest. But here's what the American public was never told. The reason they sent their troops into Manchuria was because Stalin, in his aggressive expansion, had seized the northwestern province of China called Xinjiang. He also had seized Outer Mongolia. This is part of the whole Soviet plan of expansion, which previously they took it over Ukraine, Belarus, eventually took over the Balkans, invaded Finland, and so forth. So the Japanese, seeing this, sent their troops to hold back the Russians. And I'm going to quote in support of this Dr. Anthony Kubik in his book, How the Far East Was Lost. Quote, it was apparent to Japanese statesmen that unless bastions of defense were built in Manchuria and Inner Mongolia, communism would spread all through North China and threaten the security of Japan. To the Japanese, expansion in Manchuria was an imperative. But the State Department seemed not to regard Japan as a bulwark against Soviet expansion in China. As a matter of fact, not one word of protest was sent by the State Department to the Soviet Union, despite her absorption of Xinjiang and Outer Mongolia, while at the same time, Japan was censured for stationing troops in China, unquote. And, Deanna, to the Japanese, they were just implementing their own version of the Monroe Doctrine, which said we're not going to let foreign communists come in here for the Soviet Union into Asia. And if people think they didn't have the right to do that, I would just point out that we sent our troops halfway around the world to fight communism in Vietnam, so why couldn't the Japanese fight it on their own doorstep? But this is just part of the hypocrisy that characterized World War II. I know you know this, but I'll just iterate it. In the European theater, when Germany went to war with Poland, Britain and France immediately declared war on Germany, and the idea was that they were so concerned about Polish sovereignty, they were willing to lay down the lives of countless Brits and Frenchmen to preserve Poland's sovereignty. But that same month, Joseph Stalin and the Soviets invaded Poland, and what was the reaction to that? Yon, ho-hum, no declaration of war, and when the war was over, in which tens of millions of people were killed, Poland, which was the alleged cause of this war, lost its sovereignty to Joseph Stalin anyway, and nobody cared. But this is part of the hypocrisy. We see it being applied to Japan as well as to Germany.
Indeed, yes. And that is certainly interesting. And we do know that Japan went into China. And you have to kind of question some of the stories that have come out about their entry there. Because we've heard some pretty awful stories, like the rape Nanking. Yes, the rape of Nanking. What about that?
Well, I would just recommend for some balance on that, there's an excellent online article on Nanking by a Japanese Christian pastor named Kubo. That's K-U-B-O. So if you put K-U-B-O, I also have a link to him from my own website, and Nanjing Kubo and Nanking, you will see the Japanese perspective on Nanking quite different from what the American people were told. No doubt that atrocities occurred under Japanese occupation, but not at the level that was being reported to the American people in our ever-so-reliable media. Well, we should probably talk about how the war with Japan got going. The Illuminists wanted America to enter the Second World War, and first they tried provoking Germany. And, of course, you know the story of the Lusitania and how that was used to inflame public opinion.
Sure.
You know, this interesting family line that exists here. You know, when the Maine was sunk, which was the false flag for the Spanish-American War, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy was Teddy Roosevelt. By November of 1898, he'd become governor of New York, and by 1901, he was president of the United States. And when the Lusitania went down, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Navy was his cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who went on to become governor of New York and then president. And further extending that family line, when the Lusitania went down, you had Franklin D. Roosevelt working with Winston Churchill, his distant cousin, another cousin, who was head of the British Admiralty. All intriguing around the sinking of the Lusitania. Well, in World War II, they tried it again. And they tried many provocations of Germany, having U.S. destroyers depth-charge U-boats, but this time the Germans had wised up. They did not want America coming to the war and losing it for them, as it happened in World War I. And I'm going to just quote what Admiral Dönitz said at the Nuremberg trial. Of course, he was the commander of the Germany's fleet, submarine
right,
fleet.
Jim?
He said, quote,
Jim,
sorry?
Yes. Could I ask you to back away from your mic just a tiny bit?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
How does this sound now?
Yeah, I think better.
Am I kind of resonating off of things and bouncing and creating distortions and stuff like that?
There some people in the chat room are saying that you're too close to your mic. Several people have said
okay.
that. I'm not sure what they're hearing, but go ahead.
I thank them for that feedback. And
okay.
Let me see if this is better now. Admiral Dönitz, submarine fleet commander, said this at Nuremberg, quote, a 300-mile safety zone was granted to America by Germany when international law called for only a 3-mile zone. I suggested minefields at Halifax and around Iceland, but the Fuhrer rejected this because he wanted to avoid conflict with the United States. When American destroyers in the summer of 1941 were ordered to attack German submarines, I was forbidden to fight back. I was thus forced not to attack British destroyers for fear there might be some mistake, unquote, Admiral Dönitz. So the Germans did not go for the bait. There was no second Lusitania. And so the attention of the Roosevelt administration then switched to Japan. And they felt they could get in through the back door because of Japan's treaty with Germany. Here's what Interior Secretary Harold Ickes said, quote, our best entrance into the war would be by way of Japan. Some other quotes to support
Jim,
this.
Revisit the 300-mile versus the actual 3-mile. I mean, they extended the area of interest. The United States extended the area of interest 300 miles out into the Atlantic. I mean, that is amazing to me.
Yes, Germany is going out of its way this time to avoid a repetition of what had happened after the Lusitania, and they were successful to that extent. Let me just quote what Secretary of War Henry Stimson said as relations started to deteriorate with Japan, because he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and Skull and Bones. He wrote in his diary, quote, we face the delicate question of the fencing to be done so as to be sure Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, overt move. The question was how we should maneuver them, the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot, unquote. He wrote this after a cabinet meeting with President Roosevelt. Now, a plan of provocation against Japan was drawn up by Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum of Naval Intelligence. It was an 8-step plan of provocation, and it closed with these words, quote, if by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better, unquote. By the way, Dana, at the end of the show or during the course of the show, I'll give people the books where they can find all of these quotes, including my own online articles.
Okay, great.
Now, it was July of 1941 that brought the really severe measures, the provocative measures against Japan. That's when we seized their assets. We closed the Panama Canal to their trade. But the most important thing was an all-out trade embargo against Japan, which was very dependent on food imports to feed its population. We cut off all oil. You know, there was no OPEC to go to back then. You had to go to the Dutch or the British or the Americans. We cut off tin. And this should not be overlooked. You wonder why the United States suddenly had these severe measures against Japan in July of 1941. I believe the answer lies in June 22nd, 1941. That was a date that Germany, with several of her allies, including the Finns and the Croats and the Hungarians, Romanians, and Italians, invaded the Soviet Union in Operation Barbarossa. And Stalin was very well aware, as were his sympathizers in America, that if Japan now joined that fight, and they'd been skirmishing with the Russians on the frontiers in Asia, if Japan, with its mighty military, was to join Operation Barbarossa, it would mean the end of Stalin, because the reports coming in late June, early July 1941 were that millions of Soviets were surrendering, and drastic measures had to be taken. So this embargo basically guaranteed that the Japanese would not attack Siberia, where they would not be able to get oil, instead would move to the south, where they could get oil from the Dutch East Indies. We basically put them into a corner, and we gave them an ultimatum from our State Department on November the 26th. And the ultimatum was to break their treaty with Italy and Germany and to pull out all their troops back into Japan. Now, this was a death sentence either way. If the trade embargo continued, they were going to starve. But the condition for lifting the embargo was to pull their troops out of Asia, which would give Stalin a free hand and communism a free hand. It was a death for Japan either way. That's why they decided to fight a war against all the odds.
Wow. Yeah, that is a very significant situation. Absolutely.
And it's, by the way, it's very similar to the situation we put Spaniards in Spanish American War. We ordered them out of Cuba, and had they given into that ultimatum, everybody in Spain considered Cuba part of Spain. They would have had a revolution at home, so we gave them no choice but to fight a war. But back to Pearl Harbor. Let's talk about the horrific decision to base the fleet at Pearl Harbor. What was it doing there in the first place? It had been traditionally on the West Coast, and where our ships would be protected. And when Franklin D. Roosevelt ordered the Navy to put the fleet in Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Fleet Commander, J.L. Richardson, flew to Washington in a rage, and he had a meeting with the president and explained all the reasons why Pearl Harbor would be a disaster. Number one, our ships would be boxed in like sardines, approachable from 360 degrees of uninhabited ocean, whereas if we kept them on the West Coast, they'd stay safe. You couldn't have them on a very good war footing on Pearl Harbor because we had very limited oil storage there. To resupply the fleet, you had to go across 2,000 ocean miles, or to bring new personnel, 2,000 ocean miles. Also, 37% of the population of Hawaii was Japanese or Japanese ancestry, which meant there was a lot of potential for sabotage and espionage. And having the whole fleet 2,000 miles from home would also be very bad for the morale of his men. Now, Roosevelt was given all these reasons why he should not base the fleet in Pearl Harbor, and his only answer was, it'll deter Japanese aggression if we move the fleet closer to Japan. Well, Deanna, as of December the 7th, everyone knew that putting the fleet in Pearl Harbor did not deter Japanese aggression. But who got the blame for Pearl Harbor? Of course, it was not President Roosevelt. He was fully exonerated and glorified in the media, and all the blame, as we're going to see, was put on the Navy. I should mention that when, after J.L. Richardson, the fleet commander, flew to Washington to protest the decision, he was fired as fleet commander. He was not given any reason, and he complained to the Navy Secretary, Frank Knox, and he said, Frank, it's very unusual for a fleet commander to be relieved of his duties and not be given the reason why. So Knox put him off and said, you know, don't worry, Roosevelt will meet with you, but there never was a meeting, and finally Knox just told Richardson, you made the president unhappy. And that was the only reason given for his dismissal. The new fleet commander was Admiral Husband Kimball, who we'll be talking about. Kimball took the position. He accepted placement at Pearl Harbor because trusting that Washington, with its sophisticated intelligence, would keep him apprised of any pending attack, which we'll see was a misplaced trust.
Indeed. Oh, goodness. And of course, they did have, they knew what was going to happen. They set him up as a sitting duck, and didn't they put a lot of the old ships at Pearl Harbor so that, and then saved some of the best and sent them to Europe over to the Atlantic?
Well, they did send out the aircraft carriers, and a lot of those battleships were actually rather dated. And actually, battleships were not that important, did not play that important of a role in the actual war that succeeded Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
So I think that they were trying to sacrifice. Had it went out of disaster, it couldn't be just a Lusitania. It had to be several Lusitanias. But you're right, they wanted older ships because they obviously intended to defeat Japan and win the war. But why don't we move on to the foreknowledge that Washington had of the attack, which is really crucial. To the whole situation. Japan would communicate to its embassies throughout the world using a radio code. It was called the Purple Code. It was very complex. It had to be enciphered by machine and deciphered by machine, and the Japanese thought it couldn't be broken. But actually, in 1940, a very talented cryptanalyst in our War Department broke the code. So in 1941, when things are getting hot between America and Japan, we're reading the diplomatic traffic on a same-day basis. So what did the messages which went to, I should mention, these messages went directly to President Roosevelt, as well as Army Chief of Staff George Marshall, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, and about five other top people in Washington. Well, the messages revealed that the ambassadors in Washington had been given a strict deadline of November the 25th, and it was pushed up a week. The Berlin embassy told the Germans, quote, the breaking of war may come quicker than anyone dreams, unquote. That's November the 30th. The messages revealed that Tokyo had ordered the consul general in Hawaii to divide Pearl Harbor into five areas and on a frequent basis to report the exact locations of the American warships there. And of course, Deanna, there's nothing unusual about watching ship movements, but when the enemy wants to know where each ship is located on a regular basis, the obvious implication is they're set up for attack. And I should mention that even Japan's declaration of war, you know, if you watch the movie Tora, 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 Hollywood depiction of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese ambassadors deliver the declaration of war to Secretary of State Cordell Hull, and he's, of course, in the movie, he's shocked and surprised and outraged. He had no idea war was coming. But in real life, he'd already read the declaration of war, 13 parts of the 14-part message, from the decoded intercept the day before, so he was not surprised at all. In addition to the cracking the Purple Code, Japan also sent a separate war warning message to small consulates that weren't equipped with one of these purple machines. It was a radio message that would come three times during a weather report. It was Higashi no Kazuyami, which meant east wind rain. East wind meant the United States, and rain meant war. And U.S. intelligence was listening for that, and it was indeed broadcast that early December. So it was a second confirmation that war was coming with Japan. But on top of this were the personal warnings that the Roosevelt administration received concerning Pearl Harbor. For example, Joseph Grew, the guy who did that propaganda piece I mentioned at the top of the hour, on January 27, 1941, he wrote to Roosevelt. He said, quote, "The Peruvian minister has informed a member of my staff that he's heard from many sources, including a Japanese source, that in the event of trouble breaking out between the United States and Japan, the Japanese intend to make a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor with all their strength," unquote. And next we have Brigadier General Elliot Thorpe. Now, he was the U.S. military observer in the island of Java, which was then under Dutch control. The Dutch decoded a message from Tokyo indicating Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked in early December. They notified Thorpe, who was so alarmed, he sent a total of four warnings about Pearl Harbor to Washington until the War Department told them to send no more warnings. And you can see him, by the way, interviewed. Go to YouTube. Look for the BBC documentary, Sacrifice of Pearl Harbor. You can see Brigadier General Thorpe interviewed about what I'm just said. The Dutch military attaché in Washington, Colonel F.G.L. Weigeman, personally warned the Army Chief of Staff, George Marshall, about the attack. Roosevelt also received a warning from the FBI Director, J. Edgar Hoover, who was acting on information from Dusko Popov, a Yugoslavian spy. And you can see Popov also interviewed in that BBC documentary, Sacrifice of Pearl Harbor. Senator Guy Gillette received a warning about the attack. He shared the information with the president and said to leave it in his hands. U.S. Congressman Martin Dies of Texas said this, quote, after the war. He found a map indicating the Japanese plan to attack Pearl Harbor. Here's what he wrote, quote, "As soon as I received the document, I telephoned Secretary of State Cordell Hull and told him what I had. Secretary Hull directed me not to let anyone know about the map and stated they would call me as soon as he talked to Roosevelt. In about an hour, he telephoned to say that he talked to Roosevelt, and they agreed it would be very serious if any information concerning this map reached the news sources. I told him it was a grave responsibility to withhold such vital information from the public. The Secretary assured me he and Roosevelt considered it essential to national defense," unquote. Now, in addition to this, in terms of four warnings, for many years it was not known that in addition to cracking the Purple Code, we also cracked Japan's naval codes. And this was revealed by author Robert Stinnett. Maybe you've interviewed him. I don't know. I know he still does interviews on his book. He wrote a book called Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And he proved through documents from the Freedom of Information Act that we were translating their naval communications. And the most important was from Admiral Yamamoto to the Japanese 1st Air Fleet, November 26, 1941, quote, "The task force keeping its movement strictly secret and maintaining close guard against submarines and aircraft shall advance into Hawaiian waters, and upon the very opening of hostilities shall attack the main force of the United States fleet and deal it a mortal blow. The first air raid is planned for the dawn of X day, exact date to be given by later order," unquote, the dispatch of Admiral Yamamoto's communications.
Right. Wasn't it even in the Pearl Harbor news, the newspaper there, that there was going to be an attack?
Yes. As a matter of fact, what you're referring to is there was a ex-administrator in the FDR administration who had become a newsman. His name was Joseph Leib. And in November the 29th, Secretary of State Cordell Hull met with Leib on a park bench. Hull was actually very upset about what was going to happen, and he showed him some of the intercepts. And Leib then ran to the office of Lyle Wilson, who was the bureau chief of United Press in Washington, and he said it was ridiculous, and he did not take the story. But because Leib had some connections, he was able to get a very hurried version of the story up onto a newswire. And in Pearl Harbor, they actually did print a headline. And, you know, if you look on the Internet, I'm sure you find the picture of Joseph Leib holding up that newspaper that says Japs may attack over the weekend. But subsequent to the actual attack, Lyle Wilson, the United Press, called Joseph Leib back to his office, and they just wept at the news of the Japanese attack because they could have done something, and they didn't. There are quotes that have arisen since long since Pearl Harbor. This next quote is coming from I'm sorry, I just left my place. It's coming from Helen Hayman, who is daughter of Don Smith. He directed the Red Cross's war service before World War II. Here's a quote from Helen Hayman from the June 2, 2001 Washington Times, quote, "Shortly before the attack in 1941, President Roosevelt called my father to the White House for a meeting concerning a top-secret matter. At this meeting, the president advised my father that his intelligence staff had informed him of a pending attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. He anticipated many casualties and much loss. He instructed my father to send workers and supplies to a holding area. When he protested to the president, President Roosevelt told him the American people would never agree to enter the war in Europe unless they were attacked within their own borders. He followed the orders of his president and spent many years contemplating this action, which he considered ethically and morally wrong. I do not know the Kimmel family," that's Admiral Kimmel, Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
"therefore would gain nothing by fabricating this situation. However, I do feel the time has come for this conspiracy to be exposed and Admiral Kimmel vindicated of all charges. In this manner, perhaps both he and my father may rest in peace," unquote. Helen Hayman, daughter of Don Smith, who ran the Red Cross's war service.
Wow. But of course, they blamed Kimmel for not being alert. I mean, there was a trial or a commission right after Pearl Harbor, and FDR was wiped clean. They whitewashed everything.
You're absolutely right. And what we should probably talk about next is those very things, the hearings that were held after Pearl Harbor. Of course, America was very upset at the thousands of deaths, and they wanted to know why we were caught off guard. So President Roosevelt appointed a commission to investigate it, and it was headed by Owen Roberts. The Supreme Court Justice was friendly with Roosevelt. And the other members of this commission were Major General Frank McCoy, close friend of the Army Chief of Staff George Marshall, Brigadier General McNarney, who was on Marshall's staff, retired Admiral Joseph Rees, who Roosevelt had already given a job in Lend-Lease, and William Stanley, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but he seemed to be the only one on the commission who was interested in hearing both sides of the story. Well, anyway, the Roberts Commission conducted 3 weeks of hearings, 2 days in Washington, 19 in Hawaii. And at the conclusion, they said that all the fault for Pearl Harbor was our officers in Hawaii. They said that Washington had discharged its duties in a superlative manner. And I should mention they actually gave the report to FDR and Marshall for vetting before it was even published. But they said that the fault was that Kimmel and Short had not taken adequate surveillance measures of the waters surrounding Pearl Harbor, the very thing FDR had already been warned about. And they were accused of dereliction of duty. They were relieved of their duties, of course. And the headlines were dereliction of duty. It said they were responsible for the deaths of thousands of Americans. And they received hate mail and death threats. Well, as far as dereliction of duty, let me just quote what Admiral Kimmel's intelligence officer, Edward Layton, said, quote, "There was never any hint of intelligence and intelligence received by the local command of any Japanese threat to Hawaii. Our air defenses were stripped on orders from the Army Chief himself. Of the 12 B-17s on the island, only six could be kept in the air by cannibalizing the others for spare parts," unquote.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the planes necessary to survey the waters surrounding Pearl Harbor. But I should mention that we were rolling lots of these surveillance planes out of the factories, but they were going to Russia and to England instead of to our boys, who were also deficient, by the way, in anti-aircraft guns at Pearl Harbor, which were instead going to Russia and to England.
As part of Lend-Lease, right?
Yes, right, because Lend-Lease had already begun before we
yeah.
actually got involved with the war. Itself before it became a hot war for us. Now, Roberts had run a very unusual hearing. Kimmel and Short were not allowed to have fellow officers present to serve as their attorneys. Their statements initially were taken not under oath. They were not allowed to ask witnesses questions, and they found that the commission's report omitted a lot of testimony. Well, Congress was saying they should be court-martialed, and that's really what they hoped would happen because they wanted the matter of Pearl Harbor to be resolved in a bona fide courtroom where rules of evidence would be followed. But Roosevelt said no. He said, oh, we've already punished these men. We don't need courts-martial. And he said, we'll delay that until such time as the public interest permits. Well, Deanna, by 1944, we're winning the war, and Congress said public interest permits. And they mandated that trials take place. So in November 44, you had the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Naval Court of Inquiry meeting. And at these trials, the attorneys for Kimmel and Short presented undeniable evidence, which much of which you've already talked about, that Washington knew about the attack but withheld it from the commanders. Now, the admirals on the Naval Court of Inquiry were so upset they threw their pencils on the floor. They completely exonerated Admiral Kimmel and lay all the blame on Washington. And the Army Pearl Harbor Board reached the same conclusion, and here's their closing statement, which you can read online today. Quote, up to the morning of December 7th, 1941, everything that the Japanese were planning to do was known to the United States, unquote. Now, Dana, this should have been a scandal for FDR, but the public didn't find out because in the interest of national security, he quashed publication of the results. And in the meantime, he knew that sooner or later they would become public, so what he did was he appointed special investigators who now overturned the findings of the trials. One was Henry Clausen, Army Lieutenant Colonel, and the other was John Sonnet, Lieutenant Commander, who investigated the naval hearing. And they started collecting, quote-unquote, new evidence, which meant they went to various officers who testified about Washington's foreign launch of the attack and persuaded them to change their testimony. And I should mention, by the way, for a lieutenant colonel to overturn the decision of generals or lieutenant commander to overturn a decision made by admirals was completely unprecedented. But that's what happened. So I'll give an example of overturned testimony. Colonel Rufus Bratton was in the War Department, and he had informed the Army Pearl Harbor Board that he delivered the initial parts of Japan's declaration of war to General Marshall. Now in Germany, Henry Clausen flagged Bratton down, and he handed him an affidavit from Marshall and Marshall's secretary and General Gero, saying that the deliveries were never made. Now you're a colonel. It's your word against the Army Chief of Staff. What are you going to do? He recanted his testimony, said, gee, I guess I made a mistake. I guess I didn't deliver that message. And that happened in case after case. But not all the officers bent. For example, Captain Lawrence Safford, the father of naval cryptography, he was confronted by Sonnet and asked to change his testimony. Here's some of the quotes that Safford wrote, Sonnet gave him. He said, quote, it is very doubtful that there was a WINS message. Quote, it's no reflection on your veracity to change your testimony. Quote, it's no reflection on your mentality to have your memory play tricks after such a long period. So what happened was, although a few men continued to hold to their guns and told the truth like Safford, most of the officers recanted, changed their testimony. So when the results were released to the public, they had the impression that the Navy a court of inquiry and Army Pearl Harbor Board, somebody got it wrong. They've now had a new investigation that had, quote-unquote, refuted that, which takes us up to the congressional hearing. But I've been talking for a long time, Dan, and I don't mean to do a monologue here.
No, you're doing great. Now, wasn't Clausen a Freemason?
Well, you know, here's where we go into the promotions phase. This is really incredible. Look what happened to the guys who helped with the Pearl Harbor cover-up. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Clausen was subsequently made the sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite in the southern jurisdiction. That's the same position Albert Pike held. He was made head of American Freemasonry. Of course, you know that Franklin D. Roosevelt, who assigned with this chore, was a 33-degree Mason himself.
Exactly.
Admiral Stanley, who was on the Roberts Commission, was made ambassador to Russia. Rear Admiral Reeves, though long retired, was promoted to full admiral by FDR after the Roberts Commission results were published for his duties during the Spanish-American War. Colonel McNarney, who served on the Roberts Commission, was made in charge of U.S. occupation forces in Germany. General Giraud was made commander of the 15th Army. Walter Bedell Smith was made ambassador to Russia. Of course, General Marshall was made Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, and Cordell Hull was given the Nobel Peace Prize. Those are all the guys who participated in the cover-up. But the guys who didn't, who told the truth, like Otis Sadler of the Signal Corps, he just stayed a colonel. And Alwyn Kramer, who testified, he was a senior language officer in the Navy's translation department, he just stayed a captain. If you bucked the powermongers, you did not get promoted. But if you went along and played ball on Pearl Harbor, the sky was the limit for you.
Wow. Now, in April of 1995, the Kimmel and Short families asked Congress to conduct an investigation because they wanted to clear the reputations of the two men who were accused of negligence and therefore responsible for all these deaths. So could you tell us about that? Do you know about that?
It's not in front of me, but in 1995, Congress did pass a resolution which exonerated Kimmel and Short of any wrongdoing. However, what their families were after were their ranks to be restored and under the Clinton administration, that was investigated, and they were turned down.
Yeah. Isn't that awful? They rejected these petitions, and they stuck with the earlier conclusions. They issued, what, a 50-page report on December 1st, 1995. Boy, that really is awful. Really is terrible.
I should mention that Congress did investigate Pearl Harbor. It conducted its own post-war investigation in 1946, but unfortunately, the Democrats still having a majority in the Congress, they were able to get a 6-4 edge in the members that investigated Pearl Harbor. So the Democrats got to choose who would be a witness. A lot of key witnesses were not allowed to testify. Some were ordered by their senior commanders not to show up, to simply not show up in Congress, and others were simply never asked to testify. I'd mentioned Alwyn Kramer, who was in charge of the Navy Department's translation section. He was actually thrown into Bethesda Naval Hospital's psych ward to prevent him from testifying, and the Republicans actually managed to get him out. But by the time he testified, he gave a very ambivalent testimony, you know, saying sometimes, yeah, we did know, sometimes he would say we did. Democrats stuck to the party, and the majority report said that Washington was not guilty for Pearl Harbor. So that takes us up really to the books that came out. An outstanding one was published right after, in 1947. It was called Pearl Harbor, by George Morgenstern, who'd been a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and he documented many of the facts they're giving today, except the ones, of course, that came out later. Some other resources people can look for: John Toland's book, Infamy, published in 1982. Of course, he was known as the dean of World War II historians, and I'm sure you know he was a revisionist. Mm-hmm. Also, you have Day of Deceit, the book I mentioned by Robert Stinnett. You have The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor by Rear Admiral Robert Theobald, who was commanding destroyers in Pearl Harbor on the day of the attack. And, of course, Admiral Kimmel wrote his version and Admiral Kimmel's story. But, of course, these books did not get any substantial coverage. They weren't made part of the Book of the Month Club. And both Admiral Kimmel and Rear Admiral Theobald, to publish their story of Pearl Harbor, had to go to a tiny publishing house in Connecticut, the Devon Adair Company, because no major media would take on that story. So people didn't find out. It was like today. Back then, it was like today, Deanna. It's just through the media, minor, brave, truth-telling media outlets like your show or little publishers back in the 1940s and 50s like Devon Adair that people would find out the truth from. You have to look. Look and you shall find, it says in the Bible, right? Look and, and you will find the truth. But it's not easy if your head's in the major mass media.
Exactly. This is totally off the topic. What are your views on the flight, the Malaysian incident?
Well, if you go to my website, jamesperloff.com, the last blog post I have is on that flight. I'm a little concerned that, there's a lot of different opinions, and I state at the very top of the article, I said this is pure speculation, and it may be discredited within hours of publication. But it seems like a sophisticated hijack. It doesn't look like pirates. There's no debris field indicating an explosion that's been found. And they say that family members are able to ring the cell phones of passengers, which means it's not underwater. If it's submerged deep in the ocean, they wouldn't be able to do that. So it sounds like it made landfall. My concern, Deanna, I have long given some credence to the thought that the 911 jetliners were actually electronically hijacked and remote controlled to their targets. Because, as you know, there's a lot of evidence that the alleged hijackers did not have the flying skill to make the pinpoint hits that they made on the Twin Towers and the side of the Pentagon. And I'm wondering if we're eventually going to be hearing that this plane was hijacked and brought to Iran, because it moved, as you know, they say it moved in a northwest direction with this transponder off. You can turn off, as I understand it, to read some of the work of Joe Vials, a British aeronautical engineer. He passed away, and he's had a lot of criticism on the web, but he did believe that there was a system that, by which you could completely electronically hijack an aircraft and take the flight crew out of the control loop. I'm just wondering if that's what happened to this flight, and that later on it will be said that they landed in Iran and loaded it with chemical weapons, and then maybe some Western target will be hit by this plane. Because, you know, they can't say that they used the same scenario as last time. They can't say they hijacked a plane in America because all those TSA checkpoints. But
sure.
I'm just wondering if perhaps this plane will be used to deliver a payload somewhere, because they've been trying to get a war going in the Middle East, as you know,
yes.
for some time now. They've been beating the drums for war with Iran, and as you know, President Obama failed to get the airstrikes on Syria he wanted. I think they were very disappointed by that. The American public was not geared up for how many wars we're going to fight in the Middle East, right? So it's possible they're going back to the original tried-and-true formula of 911 and going to plan to hit a target with this jetliner. But that is just pure speculation. I have no evidence to support it. But it's kind of hard to figure out what is the likely scenario. I don't believe a suicide, if you're going to commit suicide, there's got to be more better ways to do it than bring down 239 other people. And it's not pirates. There's been no ransom demand. And pirates aren't going to know how to turn off. By the way, if the cockpit was taken by hijackers, you would assume that the crew would have had time to notify, send out a hijacking alert, and passengers should have been able to use earphones to notify people that they were being hijacked. Right? There's none of that. So that's why I'm wondering if the entire system of control on board may have been taken over by a sophisticated system, and obviously a powerful nation would be able to do that, and for them to do it, they'd have to have a very strong motive. But that's just speculation. It's on my website. It's a short article. I'm troubled by it, as obviously are many people around the world.
Sure, of course.
But we have this whole sequence of false flags that I talk about in my book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. That's what the first chapter is devoted to. It's called Six Wars, and we go from the main right through Tonkin Gulf and right through Pearl Harbor and Korean War and Lusitania and the war in Iraq, where there were no weapons of mass destruction. That was the original reason we were given for that. So whether or not they're gearing up for another one, I don't know, but it certainly is a pattern, isn't it?
Oh, indeed. And you do talk about false flags. And, you talk about a lot of things in your book. It's a fabulous book. Let's give it a plug here. It is called Truth is a Lonely Warrior, Unmasking the Forces Behind Global Destruction. It is available at Amazon, and I think you have a plug about it on your, yes, of course you do, under books, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. And, there it is. And it is available both in Kindle and paperback. I like Kindle. I like paperback, too. I like them both. So I'm glad that it's now available as paperback edition, too.
Right. It's nice to have both, because sometimes people want information fast. You know, if they're over in Europe, they can download a Kindle book instantly and would not have to have the lengthy mailing time and the postage costs that go with that.
Yeah, it's easy to do searches on a PDF file or a Kindle book. You can just search and find what you're looking for right away. Now, we haven't mentioned MacArthur in relation to Pearl Harbor and where he was and what he was doing. And often when we talk about Pearl Harbor, we never talk about the Japanese attack, in the Philippines the day after. And it seems like he was just not. I think he was either incompetent or complicit, because he did not have, or did he? He had access to the codes. He had access to the communication system, and it appears that he allowed that attack in the Philippines at Clark Field to occur. Without responding in any way. What are your views on that?
I'm going to leave that one alone, Dana, because I have not looked at that material about MacArthur. Probably one reason I haven't looked at MacArthur a lot is his whole conflict with Truman during the Korean War cast him in such a good light at that time. He's fighting to defeat communism, and he was removed for a desire to win the Korean War. But I have not recently looked. It's not fresh in my mind, so I don't think I could say anything edifying. But if there's anything else you'd care to share about that, I could probably learn something from you.
Well, it's just that he was certainly there, and he was very anti-communist. And let me see, just run through this here. I have a document on it. the Japanese attacked the Philippines. Hang on, this is a big document. And because they really wanted to allow the Japanese to take control of the Philippines too, for some reason. And of course they did, they hit a lot of, the Japanese collected a lot of gold in China and everywhere throughout that area, and stuffed a lot of it, hit a lot of it in the Philippines. And then we always, of course, think about the March of Bataan and how that really occurred because of MacArthur's, what I say is his incompetence, and he also was following an old policy of response there, where they were just not prepared. They left all of their ammunition and everything on the beach, and they retreated, and MacArthur managed to leave the islands just in the nick of time and left his men to suffer. It was just an atrocious, awful situation. And on December the 6th, officials sent two squadrons of B-17s from Clark Field, 16 of its 35 bombers, on Luzon down to Del Monte, Del Monte number 1. They had a big field down there where they grew pineapple and whatnot. And MacArthur left, and then he returned a few years later, triumphal return. And meanwhile, all of his people were left to the Japanese. And you had also Thomas Hart was there, and he had a fleet. It was just a big thing. The attack on the Philippines occurred, 10 hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 8th at 12:35 p.m., 196 Japanese Navy bombers struck the United States air bases at Clark and Iba Fields, and this assault effectively crippled the Far East Air Force of the U.S. Army Air Force, consisting of 35 long-range Boeing 4-engine B-17 bombers and 91 Warhawk fighters. It was the largest force outside of the United States. Clark Field lost the use of their radar units, those that MacArthur had used and had apparently ignored. The Japanese blitzkrieg against the Philippines by air, land, and sea forced the American and Filipino troops into a total retreat on the Bataan Peninsula and later to the fortress of Corregidor. Within 2 weeks following the attack, the Japanese utterly destroyed Clark Field off the U.S. air base in 4 days, along with 75% of the planes. Americans who survived the Japanese assault against Clark Field were amazed at the precision bombing and destruction by the Mitsubishi-built Zero, apparently a remarkable superior fighter plane. So, you just have to kind of wonder, well, this is a really bad thing. And what MacArthur did, how he reacted to what had happened, was crazy. He sequestered himself in a room and refused to talk to anyone. Even the Major General Louis H. Brereton, the air commander, he refused to attack Japan's air bases on Formosa despite orders from the War Department. Instead, he gave conflicting orders that guaranteed that the planes remained on the ground all morning. So it just seems like he allowed this to occur just as it occurred in Pearl Harbor. It was.
Well, that's fascinating, Deanna, and it's an area that I need to look at more. I have to say that because the United States people were preoccupied with Pearl Harbor, and so much of the cover-up and investigations revolved around the intrigue there, of course, the main spark plug for the war being Pearl Harbor, that quite a few of the resources I've read in Pearl Harbor really don't get into the details related to MacArthur's command that you just said. But it's obviously an area that needs to be looked into, and I'm glad you brought it up because I'd like to explore that now.
Right. And he later was, even though he was incompetent or complicit, he should have been reprimanded, but instead he retained the command of the U.S. forces, got a promotion, and a Congressional Medal of Honor. So somebody was rewarding him for his complicitness in the destruction of Clark Field and the destruction of all the airplanes there, because then they just couldn't respond, couldn't do anything, and the Japanese only lost 4 fighters, and yet all these airplanes were destroyed at Clark Field. And then, of course, he left, when he left, he took all of the Philippines gold with him, and then headed to Australia in a big ship.
And what's your do you have like a main resource you've used for this information regarding MacArthur's command?
Oh, gosh, let's see. What are some of my resources here? Let's see. Charles Callan Tansel, Back Door to War, The Roosevelt Foreign Policy.
Great revisionist, yeah.
Yeah, The Marcos Dynasty by Sterling Seagrave. Then there was, several resources here. I wrote a 12-page document. It was going to be part of a book that I'm doing. Also used The Coldest Winter by David Halberstam, American Caesar, Douglas MacArthur by William Manchester, General Douglas MacArthur, 1880 to 1964 by Eugene L. Razor, R-A-S-O-R. And he was also a Freemason. MacArthur was.
He was a Freemason, that's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would just mention that a couple of those authors you mentioned are liberal establishment historians, and
okay.
I know that there could have been, I haven't read those particular books, but it's credible to me that there may have been some historians who wanted to discredit MacArthur because, you know, he wanted to win the Korean conflict, and it was really the establishment, I understood it was the banker Robert Levitt who actually told Truman to fire MacArthur, and he's pushing for victory, and his orders to bomb the bridge of the Yalu in Korea to prevent Chinese forces from entering the conflict were overturned by our friend General Marshall in Washington. And so it may just be that because he's been a hero to conservatives, some of the liberal historians have tried to denigrate his competence as a commander. He certainly was commended for the landing at Incheon. And I've tended to, because he's sort of the regarded as an enemy by many of the liberal left establishment types,
mm-hmm.
I've tended not to look with as much scrutiny as perhaps I should on his conduct on the days of December 1941.
Right. Well, I also used Robert Stinnett's Day of Deceit because there's some information in there, page 173, mm-hmm. 174. But I like to look in both. I like to look in other books besides the ones that one would ordinarily look to,
right.
just to see what.
Well, some of those liberal establishment historians, some of them have access to the personal diaries and the internal government documents that revisionist authors don't get.
Yes.
So sometimes you can discern things. And after all, people like Carol Quigley and Charles Seymour,
mm-hmm.
was Edward Mandel House's biographer. He was Skull and Bones, but revelations were made about House's role in creating the Federal Reserve. So it's
sure.
certainly possible that if you look carefully at some of these documents, that while they may broadly be propaganda, sometimes you can discern a few kernels of revelation within them.
Sure. But when you think about what was destroyed at Clark Field, and that it was in conjunction with the destruction at Pearl Harbor, you have to ask, well, gosh, this seems like a hitting two birds with one stone kind of an operation.
Well, it was certainly two birds with one stone for the Japanese. How much
yes.
complicity there was in MacArthur's command. I would just have to if people were anything deliberate was done that was negative to the defense of those bases. I want to go back and start looking at some of those sources you mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's you know, you have to look at look at a lot of sources, not just one or two. I know that that some of them are mainstream establishment books. And as you said, sometimes you can actually find things, little treasures in them. Oh, it's been lovely having you on the program today. The time has just gone by so rapidly. And let's pitch your book again here. The book is Truth is a Lonely Warrior. And it's a fabulous book. I have the Kindle edition, and it is available at Amazon. And Jim's website is jamesperloff.com. Okay, you have 60 seconds to tell us what you'd like to say or conclude.
Sure. Well, the message with Pearl Harbor really is that the past is prologue, and I tried to start out today by showing how propaganda was used to build up a hatred of Japan, and also to show how Pearl Harbor was a false flag, not in the sense that it didn't happen, but in how it was misrepresented, and the same holds true for the Maine, Lusitania, Tonkin Gulf, and 911. And by the way, the military being betrayed at Pearl Harbor, as we can see, that trend continued in Korea and Vietnam and what they called limited wars. So when you see things like this happening again and again, you know, if it was just the Maine and there was one isolated incident, you could dismiss it as a coincidence. But obviously when we see a pattern, it reveals purposeful intent. And that's what we're attempting to show. We're trying to show people the truth. But often to show people the truth, you have to dismantle the lies that the corporate media has foisted on the public.
Thank you so much for being on the program, Jim. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me back. It's a delight, and I'd love to come back to discuss some other diverse topics.
Okay. You've got a deal. All righty. Bye-bye. Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye, listeners. Take care.